Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Daniel Mendelsohn. Mendelsohn is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times Magazine. Last year, he published an autobiographical book called The Lost, A Search for 6 of 6 Million. It's an amazing and rich narrative in which he searches for the truth about family members who perished during World War II. The Lost was published by HarperCollins and was recently awarded the 2006 National Book Critics Circle Award for autobiography. I'm talking to Daniel Mendelsohn by phone from his office in New York. Daniel Mendelsohn, welcome to Out of Bounds. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, you open your book with the fact that as a small child, your presence would often make your old Jewish relatives in Miami Beach cry because you reminded them of your lost great-uncle Shamil. Tell us about this.
Well, it was a sort of peculiar experience for a young child to have, you know. There were these occasions, you know, when we were visiting our older relatives, most of whom lived down in Florida at that point, and people would have a very odd reaction to me because, as I found out, they thought I bore an uncanny resemblance to my grandfather's older brother, Shmuel, who had been killed in the war. And so from a very early age, I was, you know, I felt connected to this story without really being able to articulate anything except that I was supposed to have looked like him, and that made me feel I was connected to this man long before I got interested in the real story.
Well, tell us about him. Most of the family had already immigrated to the U.S. and Palestine, as it was called then, but he didn't like New York, and he went back to Poland.
Right. I mean, we're talking about a generation of people who were born at the turn of the last century, 1890s through 1900, 1910. And that was my grandfather and his siblings. And like many, many hundreds of thousands of Eastern European Jews after World War One, a lot of the young generation then wanted to leave because there had been so much destruction during the war and the political situation was all sort of topsy-turvy, and they came to America, my grandfather and five of his siblings. One went to Palestine, but the older one, Shmuel, was the head of the family, and he was rebuilding the family business, which had been very successful before World War One, and he actually made a trip to America in 1913 to sort of scout it out and see if he wanted to settle there, and he didn't like it. He didn't like New York, so he went back to Poland, which at the time seemed like a good decision, and in fact, he did build up this family business and was a very successful businessman by the time World War II.
He was a kosher butcher, right?
Yes, they had a... you know, the area that we're talking about, where this little town called Bolochov is a very rural area where there's a lot of cattle farming, and so all of the business in this part of Poland was either meat or leather, and the family for centuries had a butcher shop and a meat shipping business, which is what Shmuel sort of built up in his lifetime.
And so the town at that time was about 15,000 Poles, Ukrainians, and Jews, and they were all living together in peace.
Yes.
Until.
This town, which after World War One was part of Eastern Poland, was a very typical community for this region, a rural town of maybe 12,000, 15,000 people, and about equally divided between Poles, Jews, and Ukrainians. And in general, the Jews were the merchants, the Ukrainians were the farmers and the laborers, and the Poles were the school teachers, the civil servants, the government bureaucrats, and these people, you know, look, we've seen this in our own lifetime. Think of Yugoslavia, you know, different ethnicities living more or less well next to each other until some trigger goes off and then the horrors begin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about what you learned about his family. You already knew that he had a wife named Esther, and he had four daughters.
Right.
Talk to us a little bit about them.
Well, you know, the really interesting and actually very moving part of my trip was, you know, you have to remember when I began this project, I was just trying to find out sort of for the family record how these six people, Smeal and his wife and their four teenage daughters, how they actually died. That's all I really set out to find. But, of course, you know, while I went around the world interviewing the last living people from this town who had known them as neighbors and friends, I realized that the, you know, the real mission that I was embarked on was actually to find out who these people were and how they had lived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the manner of their death seemed to be more and more irrelevant as I learned about them as people. And, you know, it was very moving to me because people would remember specific things about Shmuel and his family, you know, things that I was never able to know because nobody ever talked about them when I was a kid because it was all too traumatic for my relatives to remember them. You know, and so we heard about Shmuel. He was a little bit of a big shot in this small town. He was, you know, he was very tall, a little deaf, you know, thought quite well of himself. You know, the wife, we learned about the wife, and, you know, people remembered what a clean house she kept, and she had very pretty legs. Everybody used to say that Esther Yeager had really nice legs, and, you know, not big, important things, not necessarily the things you would want to be remembered for in your life, but they're the only things about these people that have survived, and therefore they're very precious to us. And each of the four daughters began to have a personality based on, you know, based on who I was interviewing. I had a, as you know from reading the book, the second daughter, Frida, or Fridka, as her nickname was, emerges as a very dynamic, headstrong, attractive, flirtatious high school girl, you know, qualities which seem to have made a big difference to her fate, actually, because she was, the, as you know, the object of a failed rescue attempt by a boy who was in love with her. And, you know, so the learning, the initial mission of learning how they died, what had been done to them, began to recede in importance as we learned who they were. You know, it was like getting to know your relatives.
Yeah, it's really
what it was.
It's really a very moving story, and it, and we discover it almost in the same time frame that you discover it, which makes it so compelling.
Yes. Well, I mean, that happens because I, you know, I wrote the book as I was making these research trips, going around the world, tracking down the survivors from this town, and that's why it has that quality.
So they're, you know, he's a big shot in this little town, and he has these beautiful daughters and a wife that keeps a clean house. And then the Nazis invade. Tell us a little bit about what you learned they went through.
Well, unfortunately, here again, what was done in Bulakhov when the Germans arrived in the summer of 1941 was unfortunately quite typical of what was happening in all of these towns throughout eastern Poland. The Germans got there in the summer of 41, and, you know, immediately they had what they called an action, which was an organized roundup and killing of Jews. The first one, typically in these small towns, was designed to demoralize the town by eliminating the leaders of the community. You know, they would get all the doctors, the lawyers.
The professionals, yeah.
And in that, and I found out that in that first action, which was October of 41, one of Shmuel's daughters, the third daughter, was taken just because she had the bad luck to be out on the street while this roundup was going on. And they took 1,000 people, and they took them to a local sort of community hall, and they, you know, very terrible things happened in that hall for about a day and a half. People were tortured, beaten, raped. You know, the crosses were cut into the chest of the rabbis. They took out the rabbi's eyes. They forced him to dance with the naked girl. I mean, you know, very sadistic, vicious, terrible things. You know, they would say, oh, it's time for lunch, and people would get up off the floor and they would shoot them all. It was a sort of, they thought of it as a joke.
Yeah, we have, I'm sure, heard all of these obscenities, if any of us have looked into the Holocaust.
As we speak, of
course,
you know.
Yeah.
And then after about a day and a half of that, they took the people to a local field where they mass graves had been dug, and they machine gunned them. So that was the first. And then And there was a lot of that going on in the fall of 1941 throughout this area. And then the next big action was a year later, when most of the Jews of the town perished. By that point, it was a much more organized event, and they took about 2,500 people and kept them for 3 days in the courtyard of the city hall. They killed about 500, just randomly shooting and torturing people. And then they took them to Belzec, the death camp in Poland. And after a while, there were about 1,000 Jews left in this town, working in forced labor camps, mostly the young, able-bodied people, or people who had been able-bodied.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were liquidated in 1943. And by that point, the only people who lived to survive were in hiding. People were created or paid for or were given hiding spaces by local people.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people. So there were, in Balakhov, just to give you the statistic, mm-hmm. there were 6,000 Jews in 1941, and there were 48 survivors in 1944.
Well, that's just unbelievable. Now you found out Chmiel and his daughter, Fredka, was in hiding, in fact, for a while.
Yes, and it was interesting because, you know, we had heard, my grandfather never liked to talk about this because it was so upsetting to him. But the one thing he let slip once is that he heard that one or all or some of them had been in a hiding place that was betrayed,
mm-hmm.
and they were then killed.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started doing the research, I actually came not to believe that story because the stories we were hearing were sort of different. And then towards the end, as you know, I heard that, in fact, this was partly true, that Chmiel, it turned out, had been in some kind of hiding place with Fritka, the second daughter. And that became a real mystery and a drama, finding out exactly what happened to them, because, you know, each person I talked to had heard a slightly different version, and I was very frustrated after a while because it seemed I'd never be able to figure out exactly what happened to them,
yeah.
what was the story.
Yeah.
But at the end, quite by accident, and I don't want to give the whole thing away, but, you know, we ran into somebody who was there the day that they were betrayed and killed, and we learned exactly what had happened. So it turned out that story was true.
Yeah, that's quite an amazing story. Now you keep talking about how your family would never talk about these people because it was too painful, but you did find some letters from Chmiel to his relatives in New York, where he was trying to get them to help him.
Right.
Do you think that's the basis of their guilt?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting because, you see, when I was growing up, I was very close to my mother's father, my grandfather, who was the brother of Chmiel, and he was a very colorful, fun, you know, funny, interesting storyteller, and that's what made me interested in storytelling from a very early age. And what struck me was that the one family story he didn't want to talk about with Chmiel, and I assumed it was because it was just too painful, which in a way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this miraculous, rather devastating discovery that we made, which is that when my grandfather died, I was in college at the time, we found in his possession this very desperate series of letters from Chmiel to my grandfather and to the other American relatives, written throughout the year 1939, in which he begs them for money, affidavits, visa applications, anything to get him and his family out of Poland. And it was only after we read these letters, which we had never dreamed existed, that we understood that the sort of the core of my grandfather's unwillingness or inability to talk about what happened to Chmiel was this terrible sense of guilt that he must have carried his entire adult life, really, because when we saw the letters, we realized that he felt guilty, that mm-hmm. for whatever reason, they hadn't been able to help. And that's why he preserved these letters, these very desperate letters. And that's why he couldn't bring himself to talk about any of that. And when I read those letters, I remember very specifically the experience in the summer of 1980 when my grandfather died and we came across this material. I remember then having this absolute conviction that at some point in my life, I had to find out what happened to these people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Mendelsohn. We're talking about his award-winning book, The Lost, A Search for 6 of 6 Million. Now, Daniel, tell us about your first trip to Balakhov You went there in August of 2001 with some of your siblings.
Right. Well, you see, it's funny because now that it's all over, you know, we made all our discoveries and it all sort of fell into place, it seems incredible to remember a time when, which was most of the time, when we had no idea what we were going to know.
Yeah.
So when this began, I just thought in the year 2000, for whatever reason, it was really not any compelling reason. I just thought, you know, this would be a good time to go back to Balakhov and see if there's anyone who remembers Shmuel. And that's basically all I thought I'd do. And I thought I'd just write a magazine article about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we went back, and while we were, and we basically just went around grabbing old people and asking them, did they remember Shmuel Yeager and his family? Because, you see, they were such ghosts for us. We didn't know anything about them. We didn't even know the names of the girls because my grandfather never mentioned them. And, you know, we had nothing. We really had nothing. And I thought, just to make contact with somebody alive in the year 2001 who knew them as a neighbor, you know, not as a saint, not as a martyr, just as an actual flesh and blood person, seemed to us to be the greatest possible dream. Mm-hmm. And that happened while we were there. At the end of a long day, we found one old lady. You know, because people would say to us, oh, I remember the name, but I didn't know them. Because it was a small town. Everybody sort of vaguely knew who lived there. But this one woman had an absolute vivid recollection. And that was so overwhelming to us that there could still be people alive who just knew them casually as neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And what actually happened is that, and so I thought I was finished. You know, my whole book is really the story of me thinking I was finished with
it. It is.
I had this great experience, and I thought, oh, I'm done. You know, and then some fateful, funny coincidence would happen that would make me go to the next step. And in this case, what happened was, about 6 months later, as I was still trying to figure out how to write a story based on this one trip, I got a call out of the total blue from a fellow who said he's calling from Australia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was just completely dumbstruck. And I said, Australia? He said, I heard, I'll never forget this, he said, you know, he said, my name is Jack Green, and I'm calling from Sydney, Australia. And he said, and I heard through the grapevine, you're looking for people who knew Shmuel Yeager and Balakhov. And I almost fell down because I thought, how does somebody in Australia know this?
It was remarkable.
That somebody in Israel had seen a copy of a tape that we had made of our trip that we had sent to some Israeli relatives. And he had told someone who had told someone who had told another survivor. And it got back to this guy in Australia who then said to me on the telephone the sentence that changed my life. He said, well, you know, if you want to know about the Yeagers, don't waste your time going to Ukraine. He said, come to Sydney. He said, because I was the high school boyfriend of Ruchola Yeager, Shmuel's third daughter, and I knew them really well.
That was amazing. I was absolutely shocked reading that in the book that you had found this man.
Yeah, well, he found me.
Well, yeah, that he had found you, but it was quite an amazing, miraculous thing.
But as you know from reading the book, every step of the way there was some bizarre, really miraculous intervention like that. You know, that this is what looking for history is like, right?
Mm-hmm,
partly you thinking you know what you're doing and having your research and your items on your list, but partly it's just accident, luck, fate, maybe, I don't know, you know, every step of the way. Look, the last day we were there on our 2005 trip, when I wasn't even there looking for anything, I thought I knew the whole story. It was just by pure accident that I met someone who bumped into someone who told me to talk to someone who led me to this person who was there the day that Shmuel and Britka were killed.
Yes, that was a very upsetting part of the book.
It was upsetting. It was unbelievable to me, but again, it was just an accident.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how so much of this book happened, partly luck, partly accident, partly just looking.
Mm-hmm. And you were never really able to uncover too much about Shmuel's wife, Esther, or the youngest daughter, Bronia, were you?
No, you know, it's funny because this is what I always think about when I think about the tenuousness of the lives that we leave and how much we leave behind, really, is that it was always frustrating to me throughout my entire search that nobody really remembered Esther, my great aunt. And it was because, you see, you have to remember, everyone I interviewed, a person now in their 80s, say, was a teenager during the war, mm-hmm. or before, in the years leading up to the war, which means that Esther to them was just their friend's mom.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And how much really do you remember of your high school friend's mothers?
Yeah, it was a good question.
Nice.
And you posed that in the book, yeah.
You know, they were a nice lady who gave you milk and cookies when you got home from school, right? But I wanted to know specific things. And in fact, the most moving moment I had was when I had just given up on anyone remembering anything other than she was nice and she kept a clean house and mm-hmm. stuff like that. As I was finishing an interview in Israel, a woman clapped her hand to her head, who had been a friend of the oldest daughter, and she said, you know, I just remembered this thing people in the town used to say, that Esther Yeager had the nicest legs of any lady in the town. And it sounds so silly, of course, but I was so excited because it was something concrete, you know, it was something real, and I thought it must have been, you know, the way your parents gossip about people. It was obviously something that people said for this girl to remember it 80 years later. Mm-hmm. And to me, I was so happy. I thought, it's not a lot, but at least something.
Yeah. You know, well, see, this is what our lives are made of, and your book made that so
right.
clear. It's just the small things. There's no big heroics in most people's
right.
lives.
These people are ordinary people. You know, the important thing I always think to remember is these people did not live their lives knowing they were going to be martyrs of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
They had normal lives, and it wasn't until the very end that the normality of their lives was taken away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have to try to imagine them without the benefit of hindsight, you know, that they were just themselves.
Yeah.
She was just a lady with nice legs. I mean, she was much more than that, but you know what I mean.
Yes, I do, yeah.
And because, you see, it's so important to remember that what was done to these people was done with the intention of obliterating them from memory,
mm-hmm.
that there would be nothing to survive. And for that reason, in my own search, which is just a tiny part of this vast event, 6 people, not 6 million people, which is an unimaginable figure.
Mm-hmm.
Every detail that we got back from that imposed oblivion was that much more meaningful because it was deliberately erased. So if the only thing that we know about Esther was that people said she had nice legs, great, because that's at least something of her mm-hmm. that we pulled back out of this chasm.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's very important.
It is. It is. All this literature and autobiography about the Holocaust, we've just got to keep doing it. Because what struck me is how literally centuries of Eastern European Jewish culture was wiped out in 4 years. How
right.
did that happen?
Right.
It's unbelievable.
Right. Because what it makes, you know, of course, I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but culture resides in the people who practice it.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you destroy all the people, there is no culture. You know, and as you know, I'm a classicist. I've spent my life studying Greek and Latin civilization, Greek and Roman civilization.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm used to dealing with dead cultures, vanished cultures. What's so extraordinary about what happened during the Holocaust is that there was a civilization that vanished in 6 years, not 600 years or 60 years even. You know, that it was there and then it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the act of retrieval, I think, is a kind of a duty. You know, because mm-hmm. as we know, this is happening right now.
It is. It is. What we thought would never happen again.
It's happening every day you open the newspaper.
That's right. Did you ever consider calling your book The Found instead of The Lost? Do you believe that you found enough to say they're no longer lost?
Well, the book was called The Lost because that's how they always were to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, I think, you know, there's a kind of ongoing argument in the book against maybe a false optimism or a too easy sentimentality, because you know, obviously I understand what your question is about, and it's, you know, it makes me happy to think that somebody thinks they were found. But we also have to remember that they still are mostly lost.
Yes.
These people. That if all that remains of you is a pair of nice legs, then you were erased
mm-hmm.
from the earth. And that my struggles over 6 years traveling literally all over the world to bring back these scraps from the past, although they're encouraging, and I think it's necessary, cannot fool us into thinking that we succeeded. You know what I mean? That,
yes.
Because
mm-hmm.
these people were destroyed.
They were.
Their way of life was obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
And just because I found a few pieces doesn't mean we should forget about the larger fact. Mm-hmm. And I'm always, as you know, in the book, sort of tortured between those two, you know, being happy that I got something and being reminded of everything that I'll never be able to get.
Yeah, yeah. Daniel, we only have about a minute left. I just wanted to briefly touch on the fact that, on a personal note, your journey to find your lost relatives brought you closer to your estranged brother, Matt, and that's got to be a gift.
Oh, yeah.
From
well,
this.
You know, as you know, he's a professional photographer, and his portraits of all our survivors run through the book. And it was, as I said, of all the things that I found, he was the best one, because we traveled together for 3 years and we became very close when we hadn't really been that close growing up. So, you know, look, the book is about looking for your lost family. And I found my lost family, and it wasn't just the ones who died in the Holocaust.
Yeah. Daniel Mandelson, we have run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.